Welcome, and thank you for attending this leadership webinar series. We are in part three today. The first part was a general inevitable you look on leadership, what makes us unique, why the system is unique around leadership. Part two was focused on the EQ toolbox, the emotional quotient of a great leader. And today, part three is really a troubleshooting day. We're going to add some more tools, but we're going to talk about when it breaks down, what happens, why did it break down, and we'll also give you some case studies to talk about. And we're really going to focus on a lot of Q&A from the audience. So again, thank you. I know your time is very valuable, and to take this hour with me means a lot. And I'm going to give you a great leadership conclusion with a bang here. So let's go to work. As I said, today is about troubleshooting when the leadership process, the leadership outcomes and expectations break down. We've got some case studies to go over, and please, out there in audience land, really be thinking of some great Q&A, because that's where we're really going to have the rubber meet the road and test and find out that this has real value to you, or is it just, you know, theory and a nice chit chat. So bring your toughest questions in to the forum, and I really would like to work with anybody that wants to have some great opportunities asked and answered. So let's do a very fast, kind of high-level review. Let me pick up a good pen here. What makes this different? Number one, leaders own everything. We spent a lot of time in this in the first series. If you've not listened to that part one, go back and make sure you catch that sometime soon. It is very different. Most leaders, and we're talking about good leaders, above average leaders, most leaders believe that, you know, they own some of it. They don't believe they own all of it. They don't believe that they own the challenges when the storms of life blow through. Well, that's not my fault, or I couldn't do anything about that. We talk about the teacher and the student as one of the great metaphors that we worked on in there, that it's the teacher's job to teach is far more important than it's the student's job to learn. And again, most leaders will believe, hey, I did a great job. I taught, I presented, I worked on my lesson plan. The student just isn't learning. Now, a really good teacher will go back and try a couple of different ways. At the leadership level that I'm talking about, leaders own everything. It is the teacher's job to teach. I don't care what the student's problem is. It's your job. You own everything. It goes back to my West Point and my military DNA. Military leaders bring everybody home, and they own the weather. If the weather's bad, they still have to do the mission. They still bring everybody home. Now, you still have allowances for failure, and we've got tools for that as well. But the primary part of part one that I really want you to focus on is that to take a really hard look at your level of ownership. You know, what level do you own in your current job, on your current team? And the more that you own, the more you're going to be driven, the more leverage that's going to be created for you to want more, the more you'll raise your standard, because you'll find ways to do things today that you didn't find a way to do yesterday, because in part you didn't believe it was your responsibility to do that. So leaders owning everything is a pretty significant shift for a lot of people. Secondly, we talked in part one and going into part two, be bold, be outrageous. So when you think about this notion, you know, is leader traits, you know, innate? Are great leaders born? And if you're not a born leader, well, what do you do? And we see some kids from early on, yes, they're natural born leaders. They tend to lead on the playgrounds. But even a kid that is perhaps shy or reticent or stands in the back, they can develop all the same psychology, all the same tools, and really can do all the same outcome. Because whether you're a fluent speaker of a native language because you were born there, or you're a fluent speaker because you became immersed and you claim that language as your own, you cannot tell a difference. You cannot tell a difference between a great leader who is natural born and a great leader who is determined to be a great leader. So part of what happens is most leaders will not be bold and outrageous because they're like, well, that's only for the greatest leaders. And I'm a good leader. I'm an above average leader. But to be bold or outrageous, yeah, I'm not so sure. And then you look at the actual tools and languages and how the rest of the world looks at it. You know, I will talk in a little bit about Steve Jobs. You know, he's famous for not listening to his customers. You hear all the time, oh, well, you have to listen to your customers. Well, when you're a bold and outrageous leader, you know your clients and customers better than they know themselves. You know your team deeper and better. You believe in your team more than the team believes in itself, more than the individuals believe. It is your job as a outstanding, extraordinary leader, if you want to be that, to make bold, outrageous. And so we have examples like John F. Kennedy. NASA had planned for a 40-year timeline to get on the moon. And he makes this inspirational speech, bold, outrageous. We're landing on the moon this decade. And in 1969, we pulled it off because a leader stepped up and did something that seems so completely out of whack to what the team believed. Or I talked about George Patton. Remember in the movie, it actually does a good job. This is an accurate historical point. Battle of the Bulge, the last big turning point in World War II. The American Army, the British Army, they're under siege in Belgium, and they get caught by a surprise German attack. And Patton gets called back to the headquarters. And he's talking to Bradley and he's talking to Eisenhower. And they're like, you know what we should have done? We need Georgie. They called him Georgie. Georgie's army there. You know, but it's going to take 96 hours to get there. And the battle will be lost by then. And George says, nah, we'll be there in 48 hours. And they're like, George, how can you be there in 48 hours? He goes, because I started movement 48 hours ago. And I got goose pimples. 48 hours ago, before the order came down, what general disengages his army from an active battle front on his own initiative, and wheels an entire set of divisions into a new battle because he knows it's the right thing to do? Leaders are about being bold and being outrageous. You'll see Bruce Lee there, one of my personal heroes. You know, I started taking martial arts way back in the day, a few years ago. And Bruce Lee was one of my personal heroes, in part because he was a man and his books are brilliant. His science is brilliant. He invented his own form of martial art. It's called Jeet Kune Do. He studied boxing. He studied kung fu. He studied the best of Western and Eastern style. At that time, martial artists from the East were very disdainful of boxers. That was a brutish form of hand-to-hand combat. And he said, no, there are elements of boxing that need to be included. And he was chastised and challenged and even ostracized from Eastern martial arts because he had the temerity. He dared to teach it to Westerners. He formed his own style. Bold, outrageous leaders. And so the question becomes is, who's your hero? Who's your leader that you want to emulate? How can you model your behavior to become more than you are? And it lies under this banner headline of, I've got to be bold. I've got to be outrageous in my choices. Now, the next question that I have for you as part of this review process is, did you write your identity down from part one, five adjectives, two nouns, and two verbs? If you have not done that, you need to do that, because the reality is, and this is the gift of all neuro-linguistic programming, you have one. You already have five adjectives that describe your leadership. It might be above average. It might be, you know, oh, I'm persistent. And persistent in and of itself is not a bad word. It's a very powerful word. The challenge becomes, is it in alignment with this new leadership model that I'm going to begin to emulate, who I want to be, how I choose, what words do I think, what thoughts do I form, what beliefs are going to be created? And in my lingo, if you're old you in this old Windows operating software doing a modified above average job, you'll do good things, you'll do above average things. It was very hard to do great things because old software is not built for greatness. It's built for comfort. It's built for safety. It was great back in the day, but in order to be great in your potential today, you have to begin to use these toolboxes differently. So you have to take the above average, tired definition, identity statement of who you are as a leader, and you have to build it new and work on installing it. And then in part two, very quickly, because that was just an awesome session. I had a great time. I had a lot of great Q&A. It's the EQ, the emotional fluency of being a leader. How do you tap into people's potentiality by inspiring them? Not how do you manage them better with spreadsheets and process maps. Those are necessary. Those are very good. They don't tap into potential. They don't inspire. They don't make people become more than they are, because all the process maps, all the spreadsheets said it's going to be 40 years to get on the moon. You have to tap into the EQ. Get into the heart and soul. Believe more in your team than they believe in themselves. And that's really what wakens that up. So let's focus on our syntax today. Here's a couple of points I want to make. Remember, today's about, when does leadership go wrong? How do we troubleshoot this process? Number one, this bold, outrageous leader will troubleshoot it differently than the above average leader. So you got to ponder, who's doing the troubleshooting? I need the bold, outrageous one to step up. Secondly, people will forgive you and give you a lot more allowances when they know that you care. They know that you're sincere. They know that in essence that you're really focused on them and what's in their best interest, even if you're pushing them. If you're doing this for your ego, if you're doing this for your own narcissistic drive, they're not going to give you a lot of permission. They'll show up. They'll do a good job. They'll take a paycheck. They won't be inspired. They won't be more. Now, I've got in orange because it's a new tool. That says stage three. In essence, when we look at a number of forms, love, leadership, personal interactions, one of the many axes that we can look at is called stage one, two, and three. In essence, what stage one characteristics are is the raw, organic form of whatever it is we're talking about. And in this case, it's leadership. So the raw organic form, meaning the sentence that you would form, the thought that you would have, the belief that you are creating. And if that raw organic form is selfish, is about yourself, is focused on your personal gain, and again, that's not bad. You just have to have consciousness about that. And a lot of people going like, oh, well, of course it's bad to be selfish. No, it's consciousness as to when you're selfish and not. And if you don't understand this, I always teach this in the tool of when the oxygen mask drops down. You know, whose mask do you put on first? You put it on your child. You put it on yourself first. You can't put it on your child. Most people, when we study air crashes, they try to put it 80%. Try to put it on their kids. But the problem isn't oxygen, and a lot of people don't understand that. The problem is hypoxia. You will pass out generally 6 to 8, maybe 10 seconds from air pressure. And when you pass out and your child's passed out, if the pilot succeeds in getting the plane down lower, neither one of you have been breathing oxygen the whole time. So if you can get oxygen on you in that scintillating flash of a second, If the pilot gets the plane down, you're going to regain consciousness fairly quickly. Now you can serve your child. So is it selfish to put your mask on first? Hell yes, it is. But it's mandatory. Sometimes leaders need to be selfish. Sometimes, and a lot of times, the women in our culture are the worst at this because they're the nurturers and they give, and they don't know when to stop and take care of themselves. And when they run out of resources, then they can't be great leaders. So leaders have to know when to be stage one, have to know when to be selfish. There are times to do that, and there's times not. Now, the same form of the sentence, the same raw, organic belief, thoughts that are taking place, but now you do it in service of others. You do it, you're going to build something. Well, are you building it for your ego, or are you building it to serve humanity? You're going to do something. Are you doing it so people will put you on a pedestal, or are you doing it so you can put your whole team on a pedestal? What is the driver and the motivation of your choices? And when you're doing things in service of others, we call that stage three. Now, there's a whole nother body of work in masculine and feminine energy that's around stage two, in essence, because I know you're going to go, well, you didn't cover stage two, Bill. Stage two is just a balance of both, a little stage one, a little stage three, a little selfish, a little service. And it's, again, it's not a bad place. We call that place consensus or balance or justice or fairness or rationalization. None of those words are bad, but none of those words create inspiration either. They don't create passion and fire and juice and drive and electricity. So having stage three awareness in how you are creating, the point of this is that when you are in service, and you care, and you're sincere, and you want the best, people will give you a lot of allowances to make mistakes, push them harder, say more bold, outrageous things to them. Whereas the older models, when we look at average to above average leaders, they're making sentences, they're creating thoughts, they're making choices about what they can and they can't, or the team can and cannot, based on rational analysis. And as all these three-part series flow together, where you are bold and outrageous, where you are tapped into their heart, their soul, their inspiration, you believe in them more, and you're doing it in service of them, or in service of what the team is built to service, you will discover that people will give you more, will produce more, will be willing to handle your growth as a leader. You don't have to be this natural born perfect leader starting out. You get to make a lot of mistakes. But if you're doing them with judgment, if you're doing them with deprecation and recrimination and blame and I'm built to not make a mistake, well, again, you can get to average to above average. You can't get to greatness, to awesomeness, to extraordinary. That's why these traits carry through in the science of it as a learned application, and you don't need to be a born leader. You just need to care a lot. And is that a natural born trait? Do natural born leaders care more? No, they don't. Caring is software. Caring is driven by how you write the equation as to what kind of leader that you are. Now, the next thing that's all part of this series as well is you have to know your team more than they know themselves. I told you I'd bring up Steve Jobs. Well, he was famous. When he developed the iPod, when he developed other Apple applications, when he surveyed his customers and said, what do you want? And the customers said A, B, and C. Jobs said, yeah, no, you don't. You don't even know what you want. You're not smart enough to know what you want. I know the vision. I have the vision. So sometimes that might be taken as arrogance, you know, the half-full version of arrogance, because I understand arrogance has a problem. The half-full version of it is quiet confidence. You are quietly, supremely confident that you know better than anybody on the planet what your team needs. And again, that's part of being bold and outrageous. That's why we spend some time on that. That you know better than what the team itself knows, than the then the customers, the clients, the people that your team is serving, you step up and say, I own this. I know what needs to be done. And the masses are saying, no, President Kennedy, we can't do it in 40 years. Or the board of Apple are saying, no, Jobs, that's not what our customers say. We're not spending millions of dollars in that line of development. That's where extraordinary leaders take root and take hold. Now, the question is, well, do I have the vision and the creativity of a Steve Jobs? Well, yeah, you do. If you're willing to be bold and outrageous, if you're willing to go out there. Again, it's not a gift to go there. It's not a select few that can go there. It's courage that takes you there. And you do courageous things. If your child was threatened, you'd lift a car. You'd chase a grizzly bear down. You'll do courageous things when it's forced on you. Leadership or stepping up into a higher level of leadership is more about your choices. It's more about the beliefs in yourself that if I did this, I can succeed. Or if I did this, it'll make the planet a better place. Caring is software. And if you fight to care more about the outcome than anybody on the planet, now you can go up against any leader that would, you know, hypothetically come in and take over your team, because at the end of the day, they might care as much as you, they can never out-care you. And so these are the things that we see as part of the foundation and hallmarks of great leaders. They worry more, care more, fight more, will not quit more. Not that they're smarter, more talented, or better. So knowing them more and believing in them more now leads you post-webinar to say, what am I going to do in my team today? Who am I going to believe? What am I going to think? What am I going to feel? What am I going to focus on? Because the above average you knows what that looks like today. You've got your reports, you got your emails, you got your to-do list. This new, bold, outrageous you is going to say, oh, man, what does today bring? Now, in a couple of other areas, and I'll wait and see if this comes up in the Q&A, but in essence, what I will give you is as extra tools, all you have to do is write me if you're watching this webinar, or if you're watching this webinar in a post video format, ask me for the foundation for change, because this is a tool and it focuses on what is the foundation. Do you have a solid foundation to put this mansion on? You know, what is the foundation for change? And then embracing change in essence says, well, how am I going to build a magnificent mansion once I know the foundation is set? So I don't want to get too far into that today because of the time and the case studies and what we're built on and what your Q&A, but be aware, those are sitting there. They're very important tools as part of your evolution as a leader, and they're available for your inspection and absorption. Now I'm just going to give you a couple of popular myths, misconceptions that I want to debunk as part of this series. If you've not heard of Theory X, Theory Y, that's old leadership. That goes back into probably the 40s and 50s. And in essence, Theory X leaders believe that people are, out to cheat you, out to get over. They're not great men and women. And so you have to watch them like a hawk, rule them with an iron fist, beat them with a whip to get them to move along. Theory Y leadership is, no, people are at their core intrinsically good, well-intentioned, and they're just waiting for leadership to go. Now, the problem with that, and the reason why it's a misconception, is you've heard me talk about in the 10 being that time when life is up, intensity is up, stress is up, difficulty is up, but that's also when growth is taking place. What happens is people tend to be theory Y as they are expanding their leadership development, meaning I'll trust people, I'll believe in people, I'll let them grow, I'll let them fail, in the 90 when it's easy, when the business model can handle that. You know, I've had CEOs challenge this, going like, well, if they're just going to lose $10,000 or $100,000 on a project, I can let them do that. But if they're going to lose $1 million, well, that would That would threaten the survival of the business. And so in essence, what they're saying is, you know, I got to be theory X at that point. Yeah, no, that's the very point in time when you got to be theory Y, because if you believe in your team more, if you inspire your team more, they will produce for you. You got to have the courage and the boldness and believe in them when they're sitting there going, no, take the responsibility from me, or don't hand me this difficult choice, versus the leader day in and day out treats them like rock stars, believes in them at extraordinary levels. So you're really going to want to ponder your theory X, theory Y toolbox, and what do you really believe? Secondly, you've heard me mention it a couple of times. Popular belief is that the best leaders are born. There's this innate traits, and those become the best leaders. And if you're learning leadership, there's something less than about that. You can be good. You can be above average. I'm absolutely here to tell you that is a falsehood. You know, innate great leaders sometimes don't turn out that way. You know, learned leaders sometimes don't turn out to be great. But if you take the toolboxes that we're talking about, if you take your heart, your soul, your commitment to care, to be bold and be outrageous, I promise you, there will be no difference at the end of this developmental journey and where you are going next in your life, in your business model with your teams, than if you were a natural born leader that just, you know, walked on the scene and you were really, really good at this. Because even those still have to do the work. Michael Jordan still had to do the practice. You cannot be full of great talent and not have to do great psychology at the same time. That's why we see great men and women all the time. Some succeed, some do not. We go, wow, that person had everything. Why don't they succeed? Because they didn't have great psychology. And that's why underdogs who are not talented can sometimes climb the ladder and get to the top, and we really root for them. Because if they can climb to the top, hey, maybe we can too. And climbing to the top, believing in yourself at these levels, again, we keep coming back to this term. It's a function of psychology. It's a function of your mental software. So in the 10, falling back to management skills or technical skills, we discussed this a lot in part one. The reason how a lot of people even begin a management track is because they're really good at technical skills and they get promoted. And then all of a sudden they're on a supervisory chain. And sometimes I always tell my favorite story about Sergeant Stark. Boy, when I first went to Germany in the Army back in the 70s, Sergeant Stark was the best mechanic you ever wanted to meet. And whenever Sergeant Stark got stressed out, I'd go down to the motor pool and he's got his 10 mechanics down there. And all the privates are sitting around smoking cigarettes, goofing off. And I'm like, where's Sergeant Stark? And he'd be on some creeper board under some vehicle working on it because he was all stressed out. And said, well, at least I'll get one thing worked on. I'll get one thing done right, because he was an amazing mechanic. You can't fall back to your technical skills when you're stressed out. Man, there was one time and I grabbed his feet. I pulled him out of that and he went swinging down the motor pool on the concrete curtain, because leaders don't work like that. If you're going to turn a wrench, it's to model for a mechanic what he should, what she should be doing. And so leaders in this stress cannot fall back to management or technical. Now you're in your 10, you've got to be a great leader. And that's sometimes where models work really well, because then you can think about, well, what would Steve Jobs do here? What would George Patton do here? What would Bruce Lee do? And you know those answers more than, you know, pulling your hair out. Well, I wouldn't pull my hair out, but rubbing my head. You know, pulling your hair out and saying, gosh, I got to do my email now, or I got to do my spreadsheets now, because I don't trust myself as an innovative, great leader. And the last thing that I'll talk about in this stretch is that this notion that leaders can't fail or leaders can't be vulnerable. Sometimes people believe that you have to be perfect. Yeah, no, you don't. Again, I already told you, if you care, if you're stage 3, if you're incredibly sincere about your motives, people will allow you to fail and mess up and be a bad leader because they know you're trying. And so to pretend that I can't do this, or I can't allow the team to see me this way or fail this way or be vulnerable this way, Couldn't be further from the truth. The more real you are, the more human you are, the more they will love you for it. So, Brian, I want to check in. What do we have any great questions out in the audience at this point? And we have the amazing Susan. Do you have any questions or comments?
Actually, under the myths, in the 10, where you fall back to managing your technical skills, and I've seen that in myself, just in my own business, what you're saying is that, I don't know how to word this correctly, but you're a leader, this is your role, and if you do the things that your, let's say, employees or your team is supposed to do, it's a reflection of your lack of confidence in them?
Well, it can be a number of drivers. It could be, and I would actually say a lack of confidence in them is the smaller part of it. The reality is it's more of a lack of confidence in you and your ability to say, you know, whatever happens at the last inning, at the 11th hour, I will find a way to lead this team to victory. And so number one, there's confidence in your ability to find that way as part of it. And then two, because you're very good at what you do, that's in part why you, the proverbial you, gets promoted to management, is because you're better at a spreadsheet, or you're better at talking to investment bankers, or you're better at the skill set. And so it's in the 10, the crisis is on, we got to get things done. You know, what do I do? I'll do this because I'm good at it, and at least I can do something, as opposed to sitting back and trusting, or sitting back and quietly inspiring, or sitting back and allowing the team to function the way you've trained and built it. And then the last thing that's really problematic about the very good technical manager, if you step in essence, what you really are saying to the team is, yeah, all these days, weeks, months that I've been building you and building your confidence and telling you that I believe in you, no, that's not true. I really don't. Because I'm going to sit here and do your job for you. And then what are they supposed to do? Do your job? And the answer is no. They get pissed off. They get frustrated. They sit back, and then when you get through that stress point and get through that problem, then you're sitting there in the next crisis, and it's even more problematic and harder, because the minute it hits a crisis, they're going to step back and go, well, she doesn't believe in me anyway.
It's like how everyone hates a micromanager. It's the same thing. You don't feel that they trust you to do your
correct
job.
And that's why micromanagement, again, there's some conscious moments. So, for example, in my business model, I tell my team at a firewalk, because I'm the best firewalker we've got, if it comes down to participant safety, I will step in. It's life or death at that point. It's life and limb. Other than that, anywhere in my business model, you know, we're going to lose money, we're going to have a bad turnout, something awful's going to happen, I'll let you make that mistake, because it's not hurting anyone, it's creating growth. And so your focus is, do I believe that this is growth? And the answer is absolutely. So again, it's not that there's these sweeping generalizations that micromanagement is bad. You have to have consciousness around it. And so one out of a bajillion times do I micromanage, but boy, it's really needed at that time. And that's my quiet confidence, or arrogance, if you will, as to when that is and how that happens. And then because I pre-framed them for it might happen, and then when it's all said and done, you know, I give them a big hug, I focus on the positives of why they're there, and everything's going on, and they're going, look, this is why I stepped in, this is what was happening, this is what I saw, this is what I think you missed. And again, generally, because you've already established that you care about them and you care about the participant on the fire lane, they know you're not doing it because you're better, arrogant, egotistical, or just a plain old dick. Mm-hmm. You're doing it because you care. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're wrong, let's say they had it handled, they'll still give you permission to do that, and it won't set up the cycle that he or she doesn't believe in me. Great question. Any other questions out there, Sir Brian?
Yeah, we got a question from one of our viewers. If you're leading someone and you're trying to inspire them or motivate them, and they're just not getting the job done, at what point do you step in and either take the job over or have to make a decision about firing that person or putting them on another job?
Great question. And we just covered this in the Inevitable Leadership with our big hospital that we're working with. And again, I'll be the first to tell you, I have fired people. I realize in business models, sometimes that has to happen. The question becomes, when you fire them, you know, and let's say you've done all the HR policies, you gave them their forms, you tracked their progress, you documented the closer and closer they're getting to a termination point, and bam, you know, now it's time to fire them. I get all that. I get the legality of this. I get the morality of this. I just want to make it very, very clear to you is that when you fire someone, that's not their failure. That's your failure. Even, again, and it lies in the tool and the metaphor, and is it a teacher's job to teach or a student's job to learn? And people say, oh, it's a student's job. Yeah, I get that. But when the teacher says, no. I'll take the dumbest, most uninspired, most incapable person of learning, and great teachers will get them to learn. Because that's what great teachers do. So great leaders, and again, I fired people, but every person I've ever fired, I have marked and taken as my own personal failure. And in my hall of fame, not my hall of shame, in my hall of fame, because I spent a lot of time post-termination studying, focusing on learning, what went wrong? What did I do wrong? Could I have done this better? What would I have done differently? And owned that lesson as my failure, not theirs. In my hall of fame sits every person that I've ever terminated because their DNA has contributed to my abilities to lead, my outcomes as a leader. And so they have contributed to not only my greatness or my team's greatness, but everybody that we serve as leaders and as teams down the line, their DNA is there. And so they're in my hall of fame. They're not in my hall of shame because I had to fire them because they were bad. They didn't get it. They were unmotivated, uninspired. No, those are always my failure. Now, I do want to honor it as a real question. You know, when do you have to step in? Well, there's going to be business drivers. So again, I want to honor the legalities of this. There's going to be life and limb drivers. There's going to be any number of real drivers. The point is, if you own this at a level 10, I am responsible for your failure. The when you step in, the how you step in will be far different than if you're doing the legal right thing, working with HR the right way, and one step back saying, well, it's not my fault. This person, they have the problem. They're not motivated. I've given them all the permission and the abilities in the world. I've given them everything to succeed, and they're just not getting it. This is their fault, so now I can step in. You will step in differently. And again, you won't rescue everyone, but I promise you this, and this is we had lengthy debates on this, and anybody else wants to follow up with this, please call or write me. You will reach far more people by being committed to inspiring, motivating, and owning their failures as yours than if you are in this either or world where it's not my fault, I did my job right, they're the problem, I just can't do anything more with them, so I feel pretty good, I'm okay with firing them. Own this from the beginning, and then the when you step in and the how you step in will be very different because the when and hows will have taken far before with you owning like, hey, there's something going on here that I'm not getting because I have not touched your heart. I have not reached your soul. I have not hit your potentiality because I hired you or you were hired because people believed in you. What happened? What failed? What missed? Yeah, you have responsibility that, but the overall responsibility, that's mine. I own that. And you'll have a different outcome. Great question. Any other questions?
Yeah. We have another question. When you have a decision to make as a leader and your EQ or your heart is saying yes, but your IQ or your logic is saying no, what do you do in that scenario?
Boy, that is one of the toughest leadership moments that you can have. And in essence, what you're looking at in a towards pattern, and if you don't know towards in a way, write us, call us. We'll send you, we got a 24-minute video. This is one of the biggest tools. In a towards pattern, you're really wrestling between right versus right. Is this more right? Is this less right? No. This is less right, and this is more right. The good news is when these battles happen, if you choose wrong, which means you're going to end up with less right, you still end up with right. You still end up with a partial victory at best. And what you really get in that scenario is a big lesson. So in the towards and away tool, we talk about Eleanor Roosevelt, who says, is failure the opposite of success? And most people, if they're just being honest and real, they'll go, yeah, of course, I didn't succeed, I failed. But she says, no, it is not only not the opposite, it is mandatory if you want success that you have to have failure to get there. And the bigger the success you want, the bigger the failure you must have along the way. So in this pattern of my heart says this, my brain says that, ooh, which one is right? Your growth as a leader is in understanding why they're not connected. And how can you force an integration and figure out how to integrate the two. And then when they're integrated, they still might not agree, but they're going to be in an alignment ultimately on what the decision should be. But when your head is fighting for this is right, and your heart is fighting, no, this is right. The good news is, in a towards pattern, you're still going to win. A lot of it depends on if you're EQ or IQ centric, which we covered in great detail in the part two. And at the end of the day, the last thing I'll leave for this answer is, when we study average leaders and above average, they test higher on IQ skills. Because IQ will get you logic and get you right. But rock stars and superstars and the extraordinary leaders test higher on EQ, because they can reach into your heart and inspire you to be greater and more than you are. So I tend to weight my EQ more, and then I just have to know that the liability and problem with that is because my passion, my drive is, you know, bold and outrageous and tends to overstep its bounds, I'm going to get some more failures that way. So if you're built to not fail, you're going to have a really hard time being EQ, because IQ is going to say, oh, the probability that you're going to fail on landing in the moon in the next decade is incredibly high, so don't say that. But an EQ leader who is inspired in service, the more you focus on these, and again, this is your growth, this is your journey, your path, your trajectory of designing and installing this new software, you're going to make more mistakes when you step out boldly, but you're going to create more greatness, and you're going to hit a lot more potentiality along the way. So I want to do a couple, three case studies real quick in the 15 minutes that we've got left.
No, we had a question from Michelle, actually, too.
Oh, great.
So one more.
Love questions. Glad to see you, Michelle. I hope you're doing well.
What recommendations would you have for someone whose leadership isn't accepted by their peers or subordinates due to age gap or due to a culture that reinforces a lack of accountability, meaning other managers don't back your word or upper management doesn't reinforce or back the struggling manager?
Well, so allow me to be bold and outrageous. That's a tough environment to succeed in. So if it is someone's, because I'm sure this is a hypothetical, if it's your cause to fight in a time and a place where you're so far ahead or you're so different, you know, the ugly duckling where the swan is working so hard to be a duck. Yeah, you can be a pretty good duck. You can be an above average duck. You're not going to be a great duck sometimes when you're a swan. So there's a placement issue here, but I'll pass that for now. I just want to note that. I'll pass that for now. And you can always ask this offline if you want as well. Because here's what I would do in this scenario if I felt I needed to be there. Number one, your ability to frame things that other people think as less than to turn them to more than is the beauty of this science and is the beauty of how this works. So, for example, let's look at age. So young people say, oh, I can't find a job because I'm too young. Well, that's the half empty. They have no experience. They haven't been hired. They can't point to any job. So they have a hard time. Well, if you look at young and reframe it as half full and say, my passion, my speed of learning, my drive, I'm so wired to win. I'm fresh. I'm new. You can mold me any way you want. And so if you're looking at hiring someone with 10 years of experience, the likelihood that they've got 1 year of experience repeated 10 times is the norm. We know that in all management studies. So I'm only 6 to 12 months behind in my ability, blah, 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 blah. You build a message based on where young is great. 90% of the businesses won't hire you, but the 10%, and besides, you wouldn't want to be at the 90% that wouldn't hire you anyway. The 10% that will hire you because they go, you know, you're right, we want youth, we want passion, we're willing to mold you, that's where you want to be anyway. So when you build these authentic messages, you'll get authentic responses. Now, what happens then is somebody says, well, what happens when you're old? Well, you build the opposite message. You're arguing against the youthful version of you 20, 30 years ago, because now you're going to say, I've got wisdom, I've got experience, my ability to judge, and the one thing that I told you always have no matter where you are, my ability to care is epic. I care more about the outcome, and I've got all this wisdom. I'm not one of those people with 1 year of experience 10 times over. I not only have 10 years of experience, I joke about a job that I had in 1987. The job was so hard, and I learned so much. We would joke that we were living in dog years, because working for this guy, Tony, OMG, 1 year with him was like 7 years in another job. So when I got out of that job with 4 years of experience, I said, I don't have 4 years of experience. I got 28 years of experience, because we worked in dog time there. It's a good joke. People would laugh and chuckle, but it was really real. We learned under that guy, as hard as he pushed us and as big of a jerk that he was at times, he cared. And we believed in him, and he got us to believe in ourselves. So when you're balancing old and saying, here's the glass half full, glass half empty on old is you're slow, you're tired, you can't learn as much, blah, blah, blah. You have to look at Michelle. So in the form of the question that you asked me, you know, where the leadership environment is less than, it's not supporting, perhaps because of age, perhaps because of cultural factors, perhaps for whatever reason. Generally, it's going to be because they have their own fears and less than models running. That's why I wanted to qualify, because you might need to do a match on the environment. But you got to stay there for whatever reason, for paying your bills or it's your job or blah, 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 blah. Sometimes it's just a boss. My dad used to say all the time, there's no such thing as a bad job. There's only bad bosses. And boy, is that true. I'd have some great jobs. Oops, I need to do that. I'd have some great jobs, and a bad boss can come in and it stunk. And by the same token, I could have a bad environment and all the environmental factors were a struggle, and a great boss would come in. Yeah, we had fun. We would tell stories about how bad the job was, but we loved being there because we learned to believe in ourselves. So modifying your frame of reference and then saying, as a bold and outrageous leader, I'm going to change how this company, how this management structure believes. And all I will tell you is my last comment, for because I've done this a long time, and I've done this message a long time, and I've heard this. Oh, you don't know who my boss is. You know, you will not really believe how draconian and backwards. They'll never go for, you know, new and innovative and bold and all these terms. Yeah, they will go for money and they will go for success. And so when you can reframe the message and create success in a new software, in a new psychology, oh, you will be surprised at what people do and don't do. Again, there's some jerks out there. Scorpions in the tool above the frog and the scorpion. Scorpions are always scorpions. I get that. But sometimes even motivated, inspired frogs can make the scorpions be more than they are. So have faith, believe in yourself. And when you begin to work this way, and when you begin to train your team this way, you turn one, you influence the second, you turn a third, the wave starts, great things can begin to happen. Great question, Michelle. And if that doesn't answer it or you want to ask another twist on that, don't hesitate to type Brian. Also, let me do some real quick case studies here just to give you some experiences. And Susan, you'll actually like these because two of these come out of your world. So in this world of leadership, I told an investor that was working with me. I was working with her in bold and outrageous and driving her business model. And she did, in a bold and outrageous model, she said, I think I can do 5 homes this year. I said, 5? 5. Scale of 1 to 10? Oh, that's, I believe I can do that. That's hard. I can get there. And even if I say 5 and only get 4, it'll be pretty good. Blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. Well, let me ask you a question. Can you do 6? And let me preframe this. This is not when you say 6, I say 7, you say 7, and I'm going to get you to 25 before it's ludicrous. I just want to know, can you do 1 more? Because here's what we're going to do with that 1. She had a passion for battered women. I said, what if you do 5 homes and you take a 6th one and you make it free and available to battered women? She was really excited about that. That's now in service. That's more passion. That drives everything. She's all fired up. I'll do 6. I'll do that home. I said, great. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to take the first one you do and give that one away. Don't do the 6th one. And there's this long silence. When you are a great leader, how you frame, how you create, how you inspire, that touched her in an incredibly deep way that she would believe in herself so much, so powerfully, that she's working on becoming a first-time investor, and she's going to take her first one and eat it and give it away with confidence, or even if it's, you know, terrified confidence, terrified. I don't even know that I'd be confident, but I'm going to do it because I can, because I will, because that's who I am. And think about this. Someone who was, you know, afraid to do this, worked on their psychology, set a goal of 5. You're working your way up the ladder. Someone who said, I'm going to take my 6 and give it away. And they're in the top 3%. They're so excited about what they're going to be able to do. But when you take the safety net away from them and say, you got to give the first one away. Oh, it so hit her core. You will discover when you get in this space and begin to occupy the space, the messaging you give, the framing that you give for people. Second case study that I want to talk about. Had a great, great man come in and, you know, why are you here? He goes, I want the dream team. I go, awesome. I said, are you the dream leader? And there was the biggest, most silent, no, because ponder this. If you're a dream leader, you'd never ask for, I want the dream team. You're the dream leader. You're always going to create a dream team wherever you go. That's who you are. That's what you do. So I knew the minute he said, I want to build the dream team, I knew he didn't see himself as a dream leader. So saying, are you the dream leader? And now we're not going to give you tools and teachings and give you this, you know, little incremental push you need to, you know, move from above average to dream. We need to move your software that you are a dream leader. You know, and now all the things begin to happen. You got to be bold. You got to be outrageous. You're going to fail more. You got tough decisions. You got to own everything. Bing, bang, boom. And when he started doing all of those things, the team coalesced. The team took off underneath him. He didn't have to do anything different as far as leadership to the team. He didn't have to do anything different for the team. The only thing he had to do was take that identity statement, 5 adjectives, 2 nouns, 2 verbs, and say, yeah, I am a dream leader. And in the Rockstar album sales tool, you got to do that before you get album sales. Because if you say that I'm going to work really, really hard and somewhere down the road, once I get dream results, then it's a dream team. I can feel confident in calling myself a dream leader. It never works that way. That's the problem. So making that shift in the beginning is awesome. Number three, another real estate investor, only this time was in a big multi-family, multi-unit environment. And so this investor was coming to the table saying, you know, I want to do this. I'm smart enough to do this. I'm capable of doing this. But then when you'd look at, was she practicing the course materials? Was she doing her homework task assigned to her and all that? She wasn't. And when you really got to the core of it, she's like, you know, I just don't know that I have a passion for investing. She's actually had passion for her job. It's just her job didn't pay a whole lot of money. And so because she had saved and was a very smart person, she could be, wanted to be, it was an IQ decision to be a great real estate investor. But she wasn't there emotionally. She wasn't there EQ. And so I said, well, look, what is your big passion? And one of her big passions was music. So I said, okay, if you took a 50-unit MDU and took 4 of the units and either gave them free or gave them low cost to music teachers, because that was her passion, and every month the music teachers in return for living there would give concerts in the common area, and they were required to give discounted music lessons to anybody there. And now she renamed her first complex a really incredible song name that connected it to music. And that was all her literature. Now people that wanted to live there were people who loved music and had kids. And when you look at owning apartments, as you well know, one of the more difficult things is getting qualified renters in there who are going to be reliable. What do you think the demographics on her loyalty and reliability of people came? And it came at the expense, and so ultimately she decided to give 4 of her apartments away. It wasn't 50, it was a little larger than that, but she gave 4 of them away to music teachers. And what she created was epic. And that worked so well, we had another person who heard about it, and they wanted to do it as an astronomy and star-centered, so they had a telescope in the common area and blah, blah, blah. When you tap into people's potentiality, when you believe they're more than they are, no one would have said to her, hey, I'll tell you what, you want to own an apartment building, if I give you a model that you're going to give 4 of them away, would you be interested in that? Everybody would say, well, that's stupid. That's my margin. That's my profit. But the reality was she was able to charge a premium for the other 46 units and ended up with a more reliable demographic because this is what leaders do. And we talked a little bit last time. We didn't get a chance. I got a question on what does it mean to underpromise and overdeliver? Because we've all heard shoot for the stars and miss is better than, you know, aiming for the gutter and hitting, and we all go like, oh, that's a great leadership theory. Yeah, like that's the world. We're gonna compare and contrast shooting for the stars and aiming for the gutters. Nobody aims for the gutters. If you aim for the gutters, you're not aiming at anything. You're not even in the game. It's not real. People might aim above average. It might not be the stars, or maybe it's the treetops. Nobody aims for the gutters. It's ridiculous. It's a dumb metaphor. And the metaphor of under-promising and over-delivering, when we look at this from a leadership perspective and say, well, what about if my model and the team that I'm building is about over-promise and over-deliver? You know, what does that look like and what do I do? Well, I had a CEO in here and I said, okay, so you're going to commit 5% growth to the board and you're going to over-deliver. That's who you are. You under-promise, you over-deliver, you're going to give them 6%. And I said, in this world of extraordinary, bold, courageous, outrageous leadership, you are going to promise 8% and let's say you miss it. You only deliver 7%. The reality question and the reality check, and this is going to be your takeaway question as you ponder, who do you want to be coming out of this leadership webinar series? Do you want to be the person who delivers 7% and failed? Or do you want to be the person who delivered 6% and won? And I'll let you ponder what he told me. And I'll let you ponder what you believe about yourself and who you want to be. And look really, really hard at your models. Look really, really hard at messaging and how you think about yourself and how you're creating. This three-part series, and I promise you this, even if you've seen the first two parts, go back and watch them again. Because as you look at how these build, you're going to go back and we'll even watch the first one differently. I want you to ponder who you are, how you're doing what you're doing, what your belief structures are, that you came to the series wanting to be a better leader. I don't want you to be a better leader. I want you to be a crazy, radical, outrageous better leader. Because that's what all four-year-olds are. They don't understand incremental gain. They only understand I want what I want, and I don't care if it's impossible. I still want it. And generally, they go make it happen. It's just that when we get older and we learn that success isn't like that and we have to color within the lines to get an A, we start to learn and fit in and mold that leadership becomes very hard. Born leaders are really just people that never lost being 4 years old. They want crazy things. They believe in crazy things. And at the end of the day, that's software. That's not gifts, not talents, not even reality. It's unreal to believe in outrageous. But that's where it happens. And it happens far more easily and commonly for people than you know. I hope you enjoyed this seminar series. We'll be launching our new webinar series next month. Stay tuned for the details. And I look forward to catching you on the flip side. Everybody take care. Have a great day.